Hello and welcome to this special episode of Mission Makers, brought to you from Davos, Switzerland, where I was lucky enough to be moderating a week of panels in the mountains at the Land Space Summit, which took place during the World Economic Forum earlier this year. It was a huge project, and I spent close to a year curating the programme for the summit, which was a gathering to collaborate on the most pressing issues of our current and future generations, converging the frontiers of technology and humanity to showcase the cultural essence of life in an immersive, elevated experience. We had some incredible speakers at our summit, from Deepak Chopra to the first African woman to pilot a spacecraft, Dr. Siam Proctor, and many other visionaries and thought leaders. I'll be sharing a few highlights from our panel discussions over the next few weeks, so stay tuned and let's dive straight into today's episode.
We are going to be talking about the future of leadership today. And on stage, I have with me Leonor Diaz Alcantara, CEO of the Montessori Group, and Sabine Nanji, my sister, who's the co-founder of Step by Step Montessori. And today we're going to be talking about cultivating the Montessori mindset for future generations to thrive. Because when we consider that 90% of our adult brain forms by the age of five, it's absolutely imperative that the messages and education that we receive in childhood focus not only in unlocking our academic potential, but also in nurturing the values and the behaviours that go on to shape our adult selves. And so today, as we wrap up the final day of the summit here in Davos, we focus on why harmonising and supporting humanity is one of the most crucial things we all have a responsibility towards. And so in today's panel, we'll be discussing one of the most widely adopted philosophies around the world called the Montessori, which nurtures each child's natural desire for knowledge, understanding and respect, unlocking the true potential of their minds and missions that we were born on here to, on Earth to achieve. So Leonor, tell the audience a little bit about yourself and the work that you're doing and who you represent.
Okay. So I'm Leonor, I'm CEO of the Montessori Group, as you've heard. The Montessori Group is one of three global umbrella organisations for Montessori. We support Montessori schools, we train teachers, we have an accreditation scheme. But at the heart of everything that we do is social impact, because Maria Montessori's first school was in the slums of Rome, working with the most disadvantaged children, and we believe that that is what we should be doing. That is at the heart of everything that we do. And we are very pleased to work with schools across 94 countries.
Amazing. Thank you so much. We're delighted to have you with us, Leonor. And Sabine, tell our audience a little bit about your work.
Hi, I'm Sabine, and I run Step by Step Montessori in London. And I've been going on this journey about understanding the mind of the child for the last 8 years. And I feel now more than ever, we need to be creative in what we're doing for the next generation, because they're going to need an education which can stand them strong in all the challenges that they're facing. And when I look around the world and I feel, and I can see this disconnect that we have to our natural world, it makes me even more passionate, because I believe these problems that we're facing, they're all man-made. So then we can get ourselves out of them too. And my path to that is through the youngest generation, with the work that I do with the children each and every day.
Fantastic. It's amazing the work that you do, and obviously I witness it firsthand, and I work closely with Leonor as well, and it's much, much needed work that we have to sort of adopt. So Sabine, tell us about the key sort of pillars of the Montessori method.
Yep. So the way I would describe the essence of Montessori is, if you're lucky enough to have had a teacher in your life who you haven't forgotten, somebody who's understood you as a human being, that deep knowledge of somebody and really getting to the core of what makes them unique and special. If we think about it, the odds of every human being born as they are, the odds of Farah or Leonor are 1 in 400 trillion. And when we start an approach from that mindset of love and care and respect of the human being, everything changes and shifts, because instead of having a top-down approach to learning, we have a bottom-up approach in which every human being's potential becomes unlocked. And that just empowers the human being in a way, because you set their potential free rather than it dying inside of them. And so I really believe that Montessori is about unfolding the human being as nature intended. And I think that's the way I would summarize it. And I think the other part to what one of the big cornerstones of Montessori is, the classroom should reflect society. They should be a microcosm of what the world, what a peaceful world looks like. And so in a Montessori class, we have mixed age groups. And that's how we all live. We all have friends who are older than us, who are younger than us. And by standardizing and segregating by age groups, in one way, perhaps the view was it could make life easier for the teachers so that everyone would perhaps be more or less the same age. But we've stripped away that fundamental beauty of living in harmony with one another and creating a community. And so in a Montessori classroom, we really view it as a little community of tiny humans who can function harmoniously together. And I think that's one of the biggest strengths as well that I personally feel when I'm doing my work with the children. And I feel the last part to what really stands out about Montessori is children are given time to really explore their interests and who they are. They're not rushed in 30, 40, 50 minute blocks of time to circulate between different subjects. They can reach that deep flow state because they're given the means in which that's possible. And I find that so transformative because you can go so deep in your learning when you're given time and the ability to pursue your interests as well.
Absolutely. Leonor, is there anything you'd like to add?
I think it's absolutely right. And I think that I completely agree. It's so important right now. And we need to encourage young people to build those sort of that emotional resilience. And I think the sort of approach that you're talking about does that. And we all know it's a really difficult time for everyone, but particularly for the young. And that amazing approach, that amazing kind of recreating what life is so important to prepare our young people for the future.
Absolutely. If we are always on the hamster wheel from the minute we're born, it just, you know, breeds so much anxiety, and we're not given that time and space to really develop that flow state and nurture our passions. So is there proof, Leonor, that Montessori students thrive more in this world?
Well there is. You know, first of all, we have over 100 years of Montessori, so we have a lot of anecdotal information that we know. And I think you can ask any practitioner across the world and they will come up with countless stories of how children have thrived. And even when they've left the Montessori setting to go into a more mainstream school, you know, feedback from teachers who have said that, you know, how advanced the children are that have come from a Montessori setting. But there is actually also research, mostly in the US. Two big studies were done, longitudinal studies. One actually looked at children from more deprived socioeconomic backgrounds and matched them against children from wealthier backgrounds. And it was found that the children who had gone through Montessori from a poorer background actually were achieving as well as, if not better, than the children from the wealthy background. This isn't news to us because that's really where Maria Montessori started. You know, her first school was in the slums of Rome. That's why she became so well known, because she could show that it was very good at reducing that achievement gap. But there is research there. There is also other research that has been done also by Professor Lillard that shows that she looked at adults and looked at where they had their early years schooling. And the adults that had been to Montessori had better mental and physical health than those that hadn't. So it actually has an impact holistically. We want to recreate that research here in Europe and in the UK. So we last year we launched a €90,000 European Researcher Fund and €150,000 UK Researcher Fund in order to actually carry out research, to actually look at this also within the UK and within the European settings. This is announced here, so you're going to be the first to hear it. We've just created a partnership with Bloomsbury Publishing House to do a new journal that will publish research that looks at Montessori. So this will become a bit like The Lancet for medicine or The Economist for business. This will become a journal for researchers in this field as well. We want to show it works.
Well, congratulations. There's no better place to announce that than right here in the mountains. Sabine, do you have anything to add to what Leonor said?
Well, I mean, it's an anecdotal story, but I went to Montessori as a child, and when I started my training, I'd left my childhood behind me. You know, you go through the paces. And when I was 21 and I started this journey, I was just struck with this overwhelming sense of gratitude to the people who were in my childhood. And that feeling has never left me. In fact, it's grown more and more over time. So I think the people who really invest their time in giving children the proper education, it will stay for life, the impact of that.
And it has a huge mess when it's not given properly. Creates, it's so difficult to rewire that and unpick what you've learned. So we've talked about flow state, but also why is it important for children to cultivate their passions, interests and inclinations from an early age? How can this benefit us later on in life if we discover that from a much earlier age?
Well, I feel like all of us go on this journey, isn't it? You know, we, at some point in our life, we do want to find what is it that's inside of us. And can you imagine if we could have that from the beginning, what that would do to people's relationship to their world, to their work? Because I believe work should be meaningful and it should come from within. And I believe as well, from what I've seen with the children, that it's so possible if you prepare an environment that children will fall in love with all different parts. Maths isn't something people fear, nor is reading or writing. These are natural processes that have developed from the earliest people in the caves making pictures and symbols to express themselves. We have sucked that joy out of education. And one of the beauties of Montessori is the environment acts as the third teacher. So it's prepared in a way that children just fall in love with what they do. And they're given that chance to really explore and go deep with what they're doing. And I find that, you know, as Montessori said, the secret to teaching is motivation. And if the child has motivation, it's like a spiral, because once they start realizing that they can do something, they want to do it even more, and then they go on this whole journey with the guide helping them on that process to go further and further with what they know. So I believe that it's such a shift in our understanding to feel that you should love what you do and you should love it from the beginning. You know, why have we taken that away from people? When you think of the word educate, what it really means for me is to get out the potential and to get out the good in the human being. So we need to think of our educational systems in that same light and not strip away that joy from the learning process.
And I would add to that, that you're absolutely right. You know, we should all continue learning as we grow older. We should never stop learning. And if we have that love and curiosity for learning knocked out of us, then, you know, that is going to impoverish us as adults, because we should want to always learn something new and be unafraid to explore new ideas, new thoughts, new ways of doing things. And that's just so essential for our kind of emotional, mental well-being, to be able to have that space to do something different from our day jobs. And also, I think we forget that in work, how we innovate at work comes from lots of different ideas and areas. So it's not, so for my previous job, I ran a medical research institute, and we would encourage the scientists to actually do something creative like music or art, and actually they became better scientists as a result, because we were able to sort of open up their minds to other ideas that would come from somewhere else that wasn't the sort of the strict rigorous discipline of their day-to-day scientific research. So I think it's essential that, you know, people like you develop, you know, our children to have that ability to continue learning and that love for learning and curiosity. That's what makes us human beings.
Absolutely.
It's, you know, the education system feels like a fear-based system.
Yeah.
Where if you don't get into the right school aged 5 and pass the right entrance exam, you know, the course of your life is set out for you. And I really believe that, you know, one is being so lucky to know what your passion is, but you need those people around you when you're much younger to help give you that flow state and that time and space. And then secondly, of course, having the chance to go after your passion is also vitally important. So Leonore, how can this method forge future leaders who can do better? And can leaders access this method no matter what stage you are in life?
Absolutely. I mean, the first thing I think I've said once I'd been there like a day at Montessori, and the first thing I said was, but this is modern leadership, and it is, you know, how this is what we as leaders want to do with our teams. We want to encourage them to fulfill their potential. We want to give them a framework, an environment, but within that environment, give them the freedom to explore and innovate and collaborate. And, you know, as Sabine said, you know, in the workplace, you don't have, you know, everybody isn't the same age. You have lots of different ages. So that ability to collaborate is really important, that freedom to be able to think and actually not to fear failure. Because that's also, as you say, it's a very fear... We're taught to be afraid of a lot of things, and we don't have failure in Montessori, it's learning. And I think that that's really important. So I think that Montessori... and leadership is really important. This is an area we're very interested in because we think that anyone can learn. And I think also in creating future leaders, it encourages young people to be unafraid, to know how to work with people of different ages, to know how to think creatively and be innovative. And we know that those are the skills that we're going to need in this digital age. We don't need an education system where we... absorb knowledge. You know, I say this often, I can access more knowledge, more facts in 5 minutes on my phone than I ever learnt at school. So why do you want to force children through that? Why not give them the opportunity, teach them how to learn and critically think, don't force facts on them. And we need to create these new skills. And this isn't just me saying this, you know, look at what even the World Economic Forum said this in terms of what the key skills were for by 2030. They were all around these social and emotional learning skills that Montessori is so good at teaching and that we need to have in our future leaders. We need leaders who understand also respect for the environment, for each other, for themselves, for others, how to work collaboratively. You know, sadly, we only need to look at what's happening in Europe at the moment, what's happening in the world, to see what happens if you don't have that respect. So this is really important. If we're going to have the world that we want, we have to give our young people the chance to experience this type of learning, or else we're going to continue going down the same path, and I don't think any of us really wants that.
Absolutely. I think you've touched on some really important things. And as we're going into this increasingly automated world, you know, and where there's so much violence, and it feels like the basic respect for humanity is lost amongst a lot of people. And having that soft skills really nurtured from the beginning is absolutely imperative. And change always starts from the roots. From the foundation that you've been given. So even though it's, you know, 100-year-old sort of method, and at the moment we're obviously going through a sort of crisis in the education system, and people are you know, sort of trying to find different ways, and yet the Montessori system exists. So how has this method sort of stayed timeless, Sabine, since it was first implemented, and do you believe it can still carry forward the next centuries coming through?
Well, I find the whole story of Montessori's legacy so interesting because I believe she was a deep truth seeker and a deep visionary. And she was born in the time, you know, in this cross between the post-industrial world. And even at that point, she felt that our systems were so backwards and so reductionist to what they were doing. And even touching on your point earlier about leadership, I feel all of us who take on leadership roles, we have to unlearn so much of what we've gone through in our education system, because to a large degree, that process kills our creativity and it kills our voice. And I find that what Montessori found in those early schools in Rome, and the fact that this method spread around the world like wildfire because of what she was observing with these children, society started calling them new children, because children were never seen in a way that could be peaceful, harmonious, kind, empathetic, caring, intelligent. And I feel that this world needs that more than ever. And I also believe that we are experiencing a collective loneliness. And from COVID onwards, I feel like we all felt what happened when we became insular, when we lost those connections we desperately need. But I believe we've been doing that to children for the last 100, 150 years. Year by year, it's becoming more and more. We don't see children playing on the streets anymore. They're not there. They don't exist. you know, most of them are cooped up on devices a lot of their time, and they're losing that connection to nature, to having that freedom to explore through their senses. And Montessori's principles of giving children an education rooted in nature, rooted in creativity, is so relevant now more than ever, and also that sense of community. I feel it's so vital to our collective well-being as well, that the next generation know how to relate to one another, and they have empathy from the beginning. I was asking my children a few days ago in the class, I said, what makes you special? And bear in mind, they're 3, 4, and 5 years old. And one of them, this beautiful little girl, she said to me, what makes me special? And she's 4 and a half. She said, what makes me special is my personality, because people like me when I'm kind. And I thought, if at 4 she can have that understanding and that social awareness, she's going to do great things for the people around her. So I believe that this method is so timeless, because these concepts are so relevant to us now more than ever before.
Could I add something to that? Because I think the other thing is, there's a misperception, and I come across this a lot when I talk internationally, that Montessori is a curriculum, and it's not a curriculum. As Sabine has said, it's principles, it's an approach, it's a method. So you can actually put it anywhere in the world. You can adapt it to any curriculum. And Maria Montessori herself evolved the approach as she, you know, she didn't sort of in 1907 say, okay, this is it, set in stone, nothing changes. She herself continued to think and reflect and learn from the children and sort of absorb that into the approach. So it's a living thing. It's not a, you know, like a curriculum that you've written down and you tick boxes, and if you've ticked these boxes, you've done Montessori. And that's why I think that's what makes practitioners like Sabine so special, because I know that for them also they reflect a lot and they learn from the children they work with and they adapt as well, and that's what makes this really quite unique. It's not, you know, but there's this misperception sometimes that Montessori is something rigid, and it's not. It's a framework, but it's not rigid. It's not a tick box exercise. So I think that's really important.
Absolutely. And so, you know, you've touched upon technology, and it's unavoidable, and many parents, I'm sure, come to both of you with those questions. So how can you sort of introduce children to technology and develop a healthy relationship with it and utilise its power in the right way without becoming overshadowed and by it?
Hey, I hope you're enjoying today's show. And of course, if you are, a little review or share with your friends would be much appreciated. But I just want to take a quick pause to share some interesting news that Mission Makers has unexpectedly grown into becoming a boutique podcast agency. And for the last year and a half, we've secretly been producing content for some high-impact brands, from tech unicorns in Silicon Valley to disruptive companies at Davos. So if you're thinking of starting your own show and you're looking for some help, then send us a message, because we would absolutely love to bring your story to life and help you amplify your content while really connecting on a much deeper level with your audiences. Now, let's get back to the show.
Well, I think with anything in life, you have to think about its intention, right? And so technology is obviously such an incredible asset to our lives. And one of the main reasons why it was created was to connect us. But I feel we've got to like a peak where it did connect us, but now it's disconnecting us. And so what we have to realize with the next generation, we have to realize this part, that it should be used to connect human beings, but we also have to understand its nature, that it is an addiction, right? It's so addictive. We're all addicted. I read a statistic that the average person spends 4 hours a day on their smartphone, which equates to 25% of their year. And we really have to realize that if we as adults struggle to self-regulate with our tech use, how is a 3 or 5-year-old or a 7-year-old able to have that capacity to self-regulate and have that discipline? They're not. So we have to be mindful when we're introducing it to them to realize its capacity. So I would say that, you know, children need to have the real skills first, then we can introduce it to them. Once they've got a mind which can reason and can use it in an intentional way, then you can use it in a limited approach to enhance their experience of the world. But it shouldn't be given just a free pass at all.
Yeah.
Because that's very dangerous.
Yeah, I agree. It shouldn't be a replacement for the essential skills they need to learn and for that human interaction. I agree, you know, technology is here. It can be incredibly useful. I think, you know, as we all realized during the pandemic, that was often our only way of connecting with other human beings was through technology. And if we hadn't had that, then, you know, life would have been even worse than it was. But it is about, I think, teaching children as well that it's a tool and that they should control the tools they use. The tool shouldn't control them. And that's really important that, as you say, we're kind of losing sight of that a little bit, that actually, and even as adults, you know, we say it's almost the phone goes and you rush to it like the phone is in control of you rather than you're in control of it. So I think that it's really important that we acknowledge the technology exists, we acknowledge that it's going to be an important part, and we should teach, you know, children, particularly as they grow older, how to use it and not to have it control their lives. So I completely agree with you, Sabine, on that one.
And so what are the challenges facing the Montessori philosophy at the moment and in the future, and how can we combat some of those?
For me, I think it's that we need more people united in this mission.
Yeah.
I think because we need it now so strongly that people really realise that. For me, I find the way that we can address the challenges we face in the world is by creating a next generation who have the skill set to be able to deal with what they're seeing. So I think more people need to know about Montessori. We need to spread her legacy further and have authentic places which really give that message of what it's about. You know, as you said, it's not a curriculum, it's a way of being.
Yeah.
So that's for me where I think
it's a way of life. Yeah. It's a way of life. And I agree. I think there's from my perspective, there are two things that I come across constantly that we're working to eradicate, hopefully. And one is that sense of because Maria Montessori did not trademark her name, anybody can call themselves Montessori. So this is one of the reasons why we created this accreditation scheme, to be able to sort of say to parents, actually, you know, this is a way that you can recognise good practice. The second thing is, I think, is as I've alluded to it previously, there is this misperception that somehow it's a curriculum, it's difficult to implement, and it's also that it's for rich people. I hear this all the time, and particularly when I speak to ministers of education in sort of countries outside of Europe, they'll say, oh, yes, but it's for rich people. And it's for rich and poor people. It's for everybody. Montessori is for everybody. You can do Montessori in your home. As parents, you can learn the approach. You can support the schools, the settings, by, you know, taking those basic principles and, you know, and encouraging your children in the home and being child-centered as well. It isn't just for the wealthy and the elite. It isn't just for a small minority of people. As Sabine says, we need to get that message out there that it's for everybody. Often I hear Montessori described as an alternative. I would say it's actually the alternative that should become mainstream. That would be how I would do it. And that's my kind of mission as CEO of the Montessori Group. I want every child to have access to Montessori, because that's how we're going to change the world.
And so the final question I have for you both is, how does this method explore the very important issues of identity, gender and race from an early age and that exploration of the self?
Well, I think children from the beginning have the sense of who they are, because they start getting a strong identity from the experiences that they have. And I think that empowers the human being, like that 4.5-year-old who knew already what makes her special. You know, they come from that sense of happiness about who they are. And then that can spread because they've got this mindset which they realize that everybody in this room is special. And they use that as a way to enrich their life and to learn from one another. And I feel that if every classroom operated from that way, we wouldn't have these troubles that we have in our world, because we would live in a peaceful world where everybody's valued and there's no competition between people, you know.
Yeah, I agree. And also, as I said, I was saying earlier about the respect. You know, if you respect yourself, if you respect others, then, you know, you're going to respect the difference and love the difference. We're not all the same, and that's okay, but we should respect that we're different and not think worse of someone because they may have a different skin colour or come from a different place or not have what you have. And I think that, that respect is sort of fundamental to us as human beings and fundamental that we teach children that respect. Children, you know, are not naturally racist or discriminatory. You know, you put children together in a room and they'll play as children. They won't, you know, particularly babies, they'll play. They don't, you know, have a sense of, oh, I don't play with that one. They learn that from us, from society, from, you know, outside influences. And I think that if we can help them understand that, yes, unfortunately, those things exist, but if we have that fundamental respect for each other, then we overcome those. I think that's a really important thing that Montessori can do and does, and we know that.
Absolutely. And I'm wishing you both the best of luck on your collective missions to really change the world through the Montessori method. So I'd love to open up the floor for any questions for our panelists. And if we could get a mic to this gentleman at the front, please.
Hi. Thank you for your presentation. I think it's really crucially important work that you do. Mm-hmm. I have two questions. One is, when you get teachers in this framework, and you mentioned that love and care and compassion, empathy are critical values, how do you look for these values in your teachers? Are there perhaps even any standardized procedures in place for testing and vetting? So that's one question, and the other one is, how does the Montessori approach differ from the Rudolf Steiner approach that was more or less, I think, invented also 120 years ago?
If I take the first one, because that kind of sort of sits in my sweet spot, is because we have been training teachers for nearly 70 years. Anyone can become a Montessori teacher. We actually have a lot of people who have come as a second career, they've had a career and they come into Montessori. I think it's what we look for, what we need are people who are prepared to be reflective. It is not an easy thing to learn. I don't know, Sabine, if you would agree that, because you actually have to look into yourself. It isn't, as I said, it's not something that you learn by rote. You know, here's a series of facts, you've learnt them, okay, you're off. You know, it really does require constant reflection. So I think what we're looking for would be people who have the ability to do that reflection. And of course, what we do is we support them. You know, we support them continuously. Often we will mentor people who have already graduated and have been teaching for a while. We do a lot of CPD because we think that's important. We encourage all practitioners to do CPD. And they want to. It's not, you know, we don't have to force it on them. It's not, again, we're not regulatory. We don't say, oh, you must, therefore. People want to learn. They have that thing. So that, I think that's we often find that people get enamoured of it almost because they see the value it brings to their own lives. We've had students say to us, actually, it's changed our lives. And when you've had that effect on an individual, then they are inspired to go out and have that effect on others. So part of it is the training that we do. Part of it is having the people who get attracted to it, people who stay the course, are people who are prepared to have that reflection, are reflective, and are prepared to kind of do that, digging deeper into themselves.
Yeah, so I'm not an expert on Steiner, but from what I know is that there are many parallels between Montessori and Steiner. Lots of the same premises about encouraging creativity, being rooted in nature, creating a community. There are many similarities between the two, and I think that's why that's also stood the test of time. And many people also want that approach for their child.
Yeah. And we work with Steiner. We're very open to collaboration because I think there are, numerous schools and organisations that are doing fantastic work. And so we're not saying we're good, they're bad. We're saying, okay, we may be different, but again, part of being Montessorian is actually learning, constantly learning and learning from each other. So we're always very happy to collaborate with others.
If I may add, there are trainings in empathy, compassion and loving kindness available from the mindfulness area, which are also standardized. And perhaps that's something where to look into for your teacher vetting and training.
Do you want to answer that?
Definitely. So, sorry, I didn't quite understand the question, that you feel that the empathy and kindness should be part of the process in which adults
for
get trained.
For the teacher training.
The answer is it is.
Yes, 100%.
It's definitely there.
You kind of can't avoid it, because anyone who's got a child, you know, it just brings out this love inside of you. And when you learn about their mind and what they need, you can't help but fall in love with what you're going to do then in that journey.
So. I think the key difference, and perhaps that's why we sort of slightly shy away from the word teacher, although there's an argument to be said that, you know, early years educators are teachers rather than, you know, childminders. Not there's anything wrong with childminding, but I think that that there's a perception almost that a teacher is there to sort of impart something onto the child. I think I would say that kind of the Montessori practitioners are more guides, they're more facilitators. So it's a slightly different approach, and therefore you can't be a guide or a facilitator, whether you're guiding adults or guiding children, if you don't have that ability to be, you know, empathetic and understand where the other person's coming from, and kindness and patience. So I think it becomes almost part of their DNA by the time they've...
And one, I think, way you could also see it is that the classroom reflects the people around you. Mm. And so if you're not seeing that come out in the class, then you have to look in yourself.
Yeah.
Because children absorb who you are, and they're going to model those values. Yeah. So I think that's one way to also...
Absolutely.
..do a test to see.
I believe Tessie has a question, the lady just behind you.
Hi, so I'm Tessie. I have had the privilege to work with all of you, and one project was really prominent and quite exciting and inspiring for me to be part of, at least at the beginning with Leonor, was you wanted, as well, Montessori, as we know, has never been trademarked, right? And as such, you can just open anywhere a Montessori school, and when we worked with each other, we have seen also some fraudulent Montessori setups where people were claiming they were using the Montessori system, but they had some other things that were not right. You were talking about creating kind of like a checks and balances, a system, the five pillars of what Montessori is, and create also for the first time in all Montessori time a connection between all the different continents and countries. Where are you within that project? And also, where are you struggling, and how can we as community and Montessori lovers as well and supporters help you get to where you need to be to kind of like create that unit of Montessori global, but as well that checks and balances, so when people go online and look for an accredited Montessori system, that is the right place to find it. Thank you.
Great question. Absolutely right. So we launched last year the STAR framework. We started, as you know, many years ago, and then we decided with COVID that life was quite tough for schools and for parents, and so we focused very much on how could we support communities during COVID. But we're now ramping that up. So we're doing this in two ways. So the first is this STAR framework, which I said is looking at what is quality look like, and we're encouraging schools to come forward and get accredited through the STAR framework, which is a very interactive approach. And it's a very supportive approach. So, for example, we give mentoring. So almost by the time someone applies to get the accreditation, they should get it because they will have gone through the process. And those that aren't able to go through that process are ones that aren't willing to make those changes. So that's part of it. We want to increase that. Part of it is getting it known. So going to the question of what can you as communities and parents do is actually go and ask your school, you know, are you accredited? You know, t- tell us what you do, because often parents don't understand that, and come back and feed it back to us, and we'd be very happy to then to have that conversation going forward. The other thing that we're doing is we made the decision to create host centres around the world. So rather than have everybody come and train in London, we are creating these host centres around the world. So any good practice Montessori setting can apply to actually do their own training courses. So we will train the trainers. That means it's more accessible to the local community. It also empowers those really good schools, like Sabine's school, to actually be seen as kind of beacons of good practice of, you know, in their region. Our job is, once we've trained the trainers, we step away. We're there to support and mentor if required. We will go in once a year just to kind of make sure that, yes, that quality of training is still being continued. But pretty much they're independent. We've opened one, I think we've opened 10 in the last 5 months. We've got one opening up in Germany, one opening up in Spain, one opening up in Malaysia. So we're beginning to kind of roll that out globally as well. But we want lots of settings to come forward and offer to do that. It's also an additional source of income for them because, you know, in some countries they really are struggling at the moment. The governments are not that supportive or not investing that much in early years. And particularly in the UK, I'm sure Sabine can speak volumes of that, but might be too discreet. I won't be so discreet. Definitely not in the UK. We are part of the all-party parliamentary group on early education and childcare, and we know what little investment there is in early years, even though it's the most crucial of the years. But yeah, definitely it's something we have to do, because, you know, if we don't have that kind of authentic, supportive Montessori, we could be damaging children. That's what really worries me. It's the damage to the children. It's not about our brand. It's about the damage to the children. So I don't know, Sabine, if you...
Yeah, I think quality is everything, isn't it? And so, yeah, we have to find a way to make that the beacon of the mission as well.
Yeah.
So I completely agree, and I'm really happy to hear all the work that you're doing to promote that as well.
Let's touch upon, you know, the lack of investment from the government. Why is that?
I'll be probably less discreet than your sister, so I'm quite happy to do that. I think governments don't understand the importance of early years. I think there are two things. First of all, I think governments don't understand the importance of early years. They think it's babysitting. They don't see it as education, which is why we talk about early years education. The other thing is, it is a predominantly female industry across the world. It is mostly women working. And they perhaps are not as heard, particularly in some countries, as they could be. So I think it's not valued. And the third, I would say, is actually we're slightly at fault because we've not shouted about it enough. I'm not saying that practitioners should, because they've got enough work looking after the children and running the nurseries and coping with everything. But certainly, kind of, I feel that organisations like myself, like my organisation, perhaps in the past, haven't been as vocal. There's been a sort of hesitancy to engage with governments and be critical of governments. We kind of got past that and said, okay, you know, we need to stand up because we can see this is not going to work. I mean, so many nurseries in the UK went bankrupt during COVID. And that means that there is no longer that facility available for that community. And no one was doing anything about it. So we felt we had to stand up and do something about it. So I think those would be the three things why. And I think that's common in other parts of the world as well.
I completely agree. I think they haven't understood the gravity that nothing replaces a happy childhood.
Yeah.
And the long-term cost of not giving children a happy childhood, because it leads to addiction, it leads to trauma, it leads to so many different aspects of affecting your life, that we need to stand up, isn't it? And we need to be united.
Absolutely.
And shout from the rooftops a bit more about the dangers of us not investing enough in our children.
I mean, this investment in early years reduces the need for further investment in social care in the future. It's a no-brainer, really. I mean, economically, forget. You know, if you want to sort of say, oh, well, we don't care about the soft stuff, the social stuff, just economically, it doesn't make sense. You know, you're going to have healthier. Well, we said for the longitudinal study that was done in the US, you're going to have healthier future citizens that are not going to require so much medical care. So, you know, you're going to have happier, more motivated workforce that are going to produce more. It's even an economic argument to be made. It just, I don't get it, but, you know, yeah.
Maybe because it's also, you know, it would be in 15 or 20 years' time, yeah, from the party that's in power.
Yes.
Right, so they're going to do the bare minimum,
yeah,
for the time that they have,
yeah,
which is very sad, but it's our reality.
Yeah, definitely very, very sad, and something that I think as a society we all need to pressurise our governments more to do the right thing. Do we have any more questions from our audience before we close the panel? No? Okay, well, thank you, everybody, for listening. We will take a quick break before we start our Q&A with Deepak Chopra. And we have fantastic panels around leading with empathy and empowerment, soft skills for a digital world, the future of climate leadership, and so on. And we also have a meditation after Deepak's session in the space as well. So let's meet back here in about 10 minutes.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as we enjoyed having these conversations. If you want to grab a copy of today's show notes, then head over to missionmakers.com/Davos, where you'll also find notes from all of our previous episodes. If you're interested in talking to me about future opportunities at Davos, producing podcasts, or coming down to some of my music and motorsports events, then you can reach out to me at missionmakers or at dj.n1nja on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. Thank you as ever for listening. Until next time, keep it laser focused.